returning home. Athens was saved. Interpretation. The victory at Marathon and race to Athens were perhaps the most decisive moments in Athenian history. Had the soldiers not come in time, the Persians would have taken the city, then certainly all of Greece, and eventually they would have expanded throughout the Mediterranean, for no other power in existence at the time could have stopped them. History would have been altered irrevocably. Miltiades's plan worked by the narrowest of margins, but it was based on sound and timeless principles. When a powerful foe attacks you in strength, threatening your ability to advance and take the initiative, you must work to make the enemy divide its forces, and then defeat these smaller forces one by one. In detail, as the military say. The key to Miltiades' strategy was his intuition to take the battle to Marathon. By placing himself at the pass that led to Athens, he occupied the central position in the war instead of the southern periphery. With the entire army holding the pass, the Persians would have a bloody time forcing their way through, so they decided to divide their forces before the Spartan reinforcements arrived. Once divided, and with their cavalry diluted, they lost their advantage and the central position from which they could dominate the war. For the Athenians, it was imperative to fight the smallest force first, the one they faced at Marathon. That done, and having taken the central position, they had the shorter route to Athens, while the invaders had to round the coast. Arriving first at Phaleron, the Athenians allowed no safe place to disembark. The Persians could have returned to Marathon, but the arrival of the bloodied Athenian soldiers from the north must have told them they had already lost the battle there, and their spirits were broken. Retreat was the only option. There will be times in life when you face a powerful enemy, a destructive opponent seeking your undoing, a slew of seemingly insurmountable problems hitting you at once. It is natural to feel intimidated in these situations, which may paralyze you into inaction or make you wait in the vain hope that time will bring a solution. But it is a law of war that by allowing the larger force to come to you at full strength and unified, you increase the odds against you. A large and powerful army on the move will gain an irresistible momentum if left unchecked. You will find yourself quickly overwhelmed. The wisest course is to take a risk, meet the enemy before it comes to you, and try to blunt its momentum by forcing or enticing it to divide. And the best way to make an enemy divide is to occupy the center. Think of battle, or conflict, as existing on a kind of chessboard. The chessboard's center can be physical, an actual place like Marathon, or more subtle and psychological. The levers of power within a group, the support of a critical ally, a troublemaker at the eye of the storm. Take the center of the chessboard, and the enemy will naturally break into parts, trying to hit you from more than one side. These smaller parts are now manageable, can be defeated in detail or forced to divide yet again. And once something large is divided, it is prone to further division, to being splintered into nothingness. By Miyamoto Musashi. As your army faces the enemy and the enemy appears powerful, try to attack the enemy in one particular spot. If you are successful in crumbling that one particular spot, leave that spot and attack the next, and so on and so forth, as if you were going down a winding road. Attacking the joints. As a young man, Samuel Adams, 1722-1803, of colonial-era Boston, developed a dream. The American colonies, he believed, should one day win complete independence from England and establish a government based on the writings of the English philosopher John Locke. According to Locke, a government should reflect the will of its citizens. A government that did not do so had lost its right to exist. Adams had inherited a brewery from his father, but he did not care about business. And while the brewery veered toward bankruptcy, he spent his time writing articles on Locke and the need for independence. He was an excellent writer, good enough to get his articles published, but few took his ideas seriously. He seemed to rant, to be somewhat out of touch with the world. He had that obsessive glint in the eye that makes people think you're a crackpot. The problem was that the ties between England and America were strong. The colonists did have their grievances, but there was hardly a clamor for independence. Adams began to have bouts of depression. His self-appointed mission seemed hopeless. The British desperately needed money from the colonies, and in 1765 they passed a law called the Stamp Act. To make any document legal, American businesses would be required to purchase and affix to it a stamp of the British Crown. The colonists were growing ticklish about the taxes they paid to England. They saw the Stamp Act as a new kind of tax in disguise, and a few disgruntled voices were raised in urban taverns. Even so, for most, the issue seemed minor, but Adams saw the Stamp Act as the opportunity he had been waiting for his whole life. It gave him something tangible to attack, and he flooded newspapers throughout the colonies with editorials, all fulminating against the act. Without consulting the colonies, he wrote, England was imposing a new kind of tax, and this, in a memorable phrase, was taxation without representation, the first step toward tyranny. These editorials were so well written and so audacious in their criticisms that many began to take a closer look at the Stamp Act, and they did not like what they saw. Adams had never previously gone beyond writing articles, but now that he had lit this fire of discontent, he saw the urgency in stoking it further with action. For many years he had fraternized with working-class people considered riffraff by polite society, dock workers and the like. Now he banded these men into an organization called the Sons of Liberty. The group marched through the streets of Boston, shouting a slogan Adams had coined, "Liberty, Property, and No Stamps." They burned effigies of political figures who had promoted the Stamp Act. They distributed pamphlets containing Adams's arguments against the act. They also worked to intimidate the future distributors of the stamps, even going so far as to destroy one of their offices. The more dramatic the action, the more publicity Adams would earn, publicity into which he could insert arguments against the act. Having gained momentum, the relentless Adams would not stop. He organized a statewide work stoppage for the day the act was to become law. Shops would close. The courts would be empty. Since no business would be conducted in Massachusetts, no stamps would be purchased. The boycott was massively successful. Adams's articles, demonstrations, and boycott made a splash in England, and there were members of Parliament who sympathized with the colonists and spoke out against the Stamp Act. Finally, King George III had had enough, and in April 1766, the act was repealed. Americans rejoiced at their first show of power. The British were smarting from their defeat, however, and the following year they sneaked in another series of indirect taxes, known as the Townsend system. Clearly, they had underestimated their enemy. Adams went to war. As he had with the Stamp Act, he wrote countless articles on the nature of the taxes the English had tried to disguise, once again stirring up anger. He also organized further demonstrations by the Sons of Liberty, now more menacing and violent than ever. In fact, the English were forced to send troops to Boston to keep the peace. This had been Adams's goal all along. He had ratcheted up the tension. Belligerent encounters between the Sons of Liberty and the English troops put the soldiers on edge. And finally, a nervous group of them fired into a crowd, killing several Bostonians. Adams called this the Boston Massacre and spread fiery word of it throughout the colonies. With the people of Boston now bubbling with anger, Adams organized another boycott. No citizen of Massachusetts, not even a prostitute, would sell anything to British soldiers. No one would rent them lodgings. They were shunned in the streets and taverns. Even eye contact was avoided. All of this had a demoralizing effect on the British soldiers. Feeling isolated and antagonized, many of them began to desert or find ways to be sent home. News of the problems in Massachusetts spread north and south. Colonists everywhere began to talk about Britain's actions in Boston, its use of force, its hidden taxes, its patronizing attitude. Then, in 1773, Parliament passed the Tea Act. On the surface, a rather harmless attempt to solve the economic problems of the East India Company by giving it a virtual monopoly on the sale of tea in the colonies. The law also levied a nominal tax, but even so, it would have made tea cheaper in the colonies because the middlemen, the colonial importers, were to be cut out. The Tea Act, however, was deceptive in its effect and confusing, and Adams saw in it a chance to apply the coup de grace. It would ruin many colonial tea importers, and it did include a hidden tax, yet another form of taxation without representation. In exchange for cheaper tea, the English were making a mockery of democracy. In language more fiery than ever, Adams began to turn out articles opening up the old wounds from the Stamp Act and the Boston Massacre. When East India Company ships began to arrive in Boston at the end of that year, Adams helped to organize a nationwide boycott of their tea. No dock worker would unload the cargo. No warehouse would store it. Then one night, in mid-December, after Adams had addressed a town meeting about the Tea Act, a group of members of the Sons of Liberty, disguised as Mohawk Indians, body paint and all, erupted in war whoops, charged to the wharves, boarded the tea ships, and destroyed their cargo, cutting open the cases of tea and pouring them into the harbor. All of this done with great revelry. This provocative act, which later became known as the Boston Tea Party, was the turning point. The British could not tolerate it and quickly closed down Boston Harbor and imposed military law on Massachusetts. Now all doubt vanished. Pushed into a corner by Adams, the British were acting just as tyrannically as he had prophesied they would. The heavy military presence in Massachusetts was predictably unpopular, and it was only a matter of months before violence erupted. In April 1775, English soldiers fired on Massachusetts militiamen in Lexington. This shot heard round the world became the spark for the war that Adams had so diligently worked to kindle out of nothing. Interpretation. Before 1765, Adams labored under the belief that well-reasoned arguments would be enough to convince the colonists of the rightness of his cause. But as the years of failure piled up, he confronted the reality that the colonists retained a deep emotional attachment to England, as children do to a parent. Liberty meant less to them than did England's provision of protection and a sense of belonging in a threatening environment. When Adams realized this, he reformulated his goals. Instead of preaching independence and the ideas of John Locke, he set to work to sever the colonists' ties with England. He made the children distrust the parent, whom they came to see not as a protector, but as a domineering overlord exploiting them for its profit. The bond with England loosened. Adams' arguments for independence began to resonate. Now the colonists began to look for their sense of identity not to Mother England, but to themselves. With the Stamp Act campaign, then, Adams discovered strategy, the bridge between his ideas and reality. His writings now aimed at stirring up anger. The demonstrations he organized, pure theater, were also designed to create and build anger among the middle and lower classes, key components of the future revolution. Adams's innovative use of boycotts was calibrated to infuriate the British and bait them into rash action. Their violent response contrasted brilliantly with the relatively peaceful methods of the colonists, making them seem as tyrannical as he had said they were. Adams also worked to stir dissension among the English themselves, weakening the bond on all sides. The Stamp Act and Tea Act were actually rather trivial, but Adams strategically manipulated them to manufacture outrage, making them into wedges driven between the two sides. Understand, rational arguments go in one ear and out the other. No one is changed. You are preaching to the converted. In the war to win people's attention and influence them, you must first separate them from whatever ties them to the past and makes them resist change. You must realize that these ties are generally not rational, but emotional. By appealing to people's emotions, you can make your targets see the past in a new light, as something tyrannical, boring, ugly, immoral. Now you have room to infiltrate new ideas, shift people's vision, make them respond to a new sense of their self-interest, and sow the seeds for a new cause, a new bond. To make people join you, separate them from their past. When you size up your targets, look for what connects them to the past, the source of their resistance to the new. A joint is the weakest part of any structure. Break it, and you divide people internally, making them vulnerable to suggestion and change. Divide their minds in order to conquer them. By Colonel Ardan Dupique. Make the enemy believe that support is lacking. Cut off, flank, turn, in a thousand ways make his men believe themselves isolated. Isolate in like manner his squadrons, battalions, brigades, and divisions, and victory is yours. Keys to Warfare. Thousands of years ago, our primitive ancestors were prone to feelings of great weakness and vulnerability. To survive in the hostile environment of our early world, animals had speed, teeth, and claws, fur against winter cold, and other advantages of power and protection. Humans had none of this, and must have felt terrifyingly exposed and alone. The only way to compensate for such weakness was to form groups. The group, or tribe, offered a defense against predators and greater effectiveness in the hunt. In the group, there were enough people to watch your back. The larger the group, the more it allowed its members to refine that great human invention, the division of labor. And the more different individuals in the group were freed from the immediate needs of survival, the more time and energy they could devote to higher tasks. These different roles were mutually supportive and reinforcing, and the result was a net increase in human strength. Over the centuries, groups became ever larger and more complex. By learning to live in towns and settlements, people found that they could escape the feeling of imminent danger and need. Living with others also offered more subtle psychological protections. In time, humans began to forget the fear that had made them form tribes in the first place. But in one group, the army, that primal terror remained as strong as ever. The standard mode of ancient warfare was hand-to-hand combat, a frightening drama in which individuals were at all times exposed to death from behind and to each side. Military leaders learned early on to form their soldiers into tight, cohesive ranks. Trusting his fellows on either side of him not to retreat and leave him exposed, a soldier could fight the man in front of him with more spirit and confidence. The Romans extended this strategy by placing the youngest, most impetuous fighters in the front ranks, the most experienced and best fighters in the rear, and everyone else in the center. This meant that the weakest soldiers, the ones most prone to panic, were surrounded by those who were braver and steadier, giving them a powerful sense of security. No army went into battle with more cohesion and trust than the Roman legions. In studying ancient warfare, the great 19th century military writer Colonel Ardan Dupique noticed a peculiar phenomenon. In some of the most celebrated battles, Hannibal's victory over the Romans at Cannae, and Julius Caesar's over Pompey at Pharsalus, for example, the losses on each side were fantastically disproportionate. A few hundred for the victors, thousands upon thousands among the vanquished. According to Dupique, what had happened in these cases was that through maneuver, the ultimately victorious army had managed to surprise the enemy and splinter its lines into parts. Seeing their ranks breaking up, losing their sense of solidarity and support, and feeling isolated, soldiers panicked, dropped their weapons, and fled. And a soldier who turned his back on the enemy was an easy soldier to kill. Thousands were slaughtered this way. These great victories, then, were essentially psychological. Hannibal was vastly outnumbered at Cannae, but by making the Romans feel vulnerable and isolated, he made them overreact and retreat in confusion. Easy pickings. The phenomenon is timeless. The soldier who feels he is losing the support of those around him is borne back into an intolerable, primitive terror. He fears he will face death alone. Many great military leaders have turned this terror into strategy. Genghis Khan was a master at it. Using the mobility of his Mongol cavalry to cut off his enemy's communications, he would isolate parts of their armies to make them feel alone and unprotected. He worked consciously to instill terror. The divide-and-isolate strategy was also used to great effect by Napoleon and the guerrilla forces of Mao Zedong, among many others. Our nature has not changed. Lurking deep in even the most civilized among us is the same basic fear of being alone, unsupported, and exposed to danger. People today are more dispersed, and society is less cohesive than ever before, but that only increases our need to belong to a group, to have a strong network of allies, to feel supported and protected on all sides. Take away this feeling, and we are returned to that primitive sensation of terror at our own vulnerability. The divide-and-conquer strategy has never been more effective than it is today. Cut people off from their group, make them feel alienated, alone, and unprotected, and you weaken them enormously. That moment of weakness gives you great power to maneuver them into a corner, whether to seduce or to induce panic and retreat. Throughout the 1960s, one of Mao Zedong's most loyal and trusted followers was his Minister of Defense, Lin Biao. No one praised the Chinese ruler more fulsomely than Lin. And yet by 1970, Mao had come to suspect that the flattery was a ruse to disguise his intentions. Lin was plotting to be his successor. And what made Lin particularly dangerous was that, as Minister of Defense, he had accumulated allies in the military. Mao went to work with great subtlety. In public, he went out of his way to support Lin, as if he too saw the minister as his successor. That soothed the natural wariness of the plotter. At the same time, however, Mao also attacked and demoted some of Lin's most important supporters in the military. Lin was a bit of a radical, veering left on most issues. Mao urged him to propose some of his more extreme ideas for restructuring the military, secretly knowing that these ideas would prove unpopular. Lin's support among the higher branches of the military slowly began to thin. Lin finally realized what Mao was up to, but it was too late. He had lost his power base. Frustrated and scared, he resorted to plotting a coup d'etat, a desperate act that played straight into Mao's hands. In 1971, Lin died under suspicious circumstances in a plane crash. As Mao understood, in political environments, people depend on their connections even more than on their talents. In such a world, a person whose career seems to be waning is one whom few will want to know, and people who feel isolated will often overreact and do something desperate, which, of course, just makes them more isolated. So Mao created the impression that Lin was losing his connections. Had he attacked Lin directly, he would have gotten bogged down in an ugly fight. Dividing the minister from his power base, and in the process making him appear to be on the decline, was much more effective. Before you launch an outright attack on your enemies, it is always wise first to weaken them by creating as much division in their ranks as possible. One good place to drive a wedge is between the leadership and the people, whether soldiers or citizenry. Leaders function poorly when they lose their support among the people. So work to make them look authoritarian or out of touch. Or steal their foundation, as the Republican President Richard Nixon did in 1972, by wooing the blue-collar types who had traditionally voted Democrat. He split the Democrats' base. The Republicans have been doing the same thing ever since. Remember, once your enemy begins to splinter in any way, the rupture will tend to gain momentum. Division usually leads to more division. In 338 BC, Rome defeated its greatest enemy at the time, the Latin League, a confederation of Italian cities that had formed to block Rome's expansion. With this victory, however, the Romans faced a new problem: how to govern the region. If they crushed the League's members, they would leave a power vacuum, and down the road another enemy would emerge that might prove a still greater threat. If they simply swallowed up the cities of the League, they would dilute the power and prestige of Rome, giving themselves too large an area to protect and police. The solution the Romans came up with, which they would later call divide et impera, divide and rule, was to become the strategy by which they forged their empire. Essentially, they broke up the League, but did not treat all of its parts equally. Instead, they created a system whereby some of its cities were incorporated into Roman territory, and their residents given full privileges as Roman citizens. Others were deprived of most of their territory, but granted near-total independence. And others still were broken up and heavily colonized with Roman citizens. No single city was left powerful enough to challenge Rome, which retained the central position. As the saying goes, all roads led to Rome. The key to the system was that if an independent city proved itself loyal enough to Rome, or fought well enough for Rome, it won the chance of being incorporated into the empire. The individual cities now saw it as more in their interest to gain Rome's favor than to ally themselves elsewhere. Rome held out the prospect of great power, wealth, and protection, while isolation from Rome was dangerous. And so the once proud members of the Latin League now competed against one another for Rome's attention. Divide and rule is a powerful strategy for governing any group. It is based on a key principle. Within any organization, people naturally form smaller groups based on mutual self-interest, the primitive desire to find strength in numbers. These subgroups form power bases that, left unchecked, will threaten the organization as a whole. The formation of parties and factions can be a leader's greatest threat, for in time, these factions will naturally work to secure their own interests before those of the greater group. The solution is to divide to rule. To do so, you must first establish yourself as the center of power. Individuals must know they need to compete for your approval. There has to be more to be gained by pleasing the leader than by trying to form a power base within the group. When Elizabeth I became queen, England was a nation divided. The remnants of feudalism entailed many competing power centers, and the court itself was full of factions. Elizabeth's solution was to weaken the nobility by deliberately pitting one family against another. At the same time, she occupied the center, making herself a symbol of England itself, the hub around which everything revolved. Within the court, too, she made sure that no individual, except of course herself, gained ascendancy. When she saw that first Robert Dudley and then the Earl of Essex believed themselves her favorites, she quickly cut them loose. The temptation to maintain a favorite is understandable but dangerous. Better to rotate your stars, occasionally making each one fall. Bring in people with different viewpoints and encourage them to fight it out. You can justify this as a healthy form of democracy, but the effect is that while those below you fight to be heard, you rule. The film director Alfred Hitchcock faced enemies on all sides: writers, set designers, actors, producers, marketers, any of them quite capable of putting their egos before the quality of the film. Writers wanted to show off their literary skills. Actors wanted to look like stars. Producers and marketers wanted the movie to be commercial. The whole crew had competing interests. Hitchcock's solution, like Queen Elizabeth's, was to take the central position in a variant of divide and rule. His carefully crafted role as a public celebrity was part of this. His movie's publicity campaigns always involved him as spokesperson, and he made bit part appearances in most of his films, becoming an instantly recognizable, endearingly humorous figure. He put himself in the middle of every aspect of production, from writing the script before the shoot began to editing the film when the shoot was finished. At the same time, he kept all the filmmaking departments, even that of the producer, a little out of the loop. Information about every detail of the film was kept in his head, his drawings, and his notes. No one could bypass him. Every decision went through him. Before the film was shot, for example, Hitchcock would set out in detail the look of the leading lady's costumes. If the costume designer wanted to change anything, she would have to go through him or be caught out in rank insubordination. In essence, he was like Rome. All roads led to Hitchcock. Within your group, factions may emerge quite subtly by virtue of the fact that people who are experts in their area may not tell you everything they're doing. Remember, they see only the small picture. You are in charge of the whole production. If you are to lead, you must occupy the center. Everything must flow through you. If information is to be withheld, you are the one to do it. That is divide and rule. If the different parts of the operation lack access to all the information, they will have to come to you to get it. It is not that you micromanage, but that you keep overall control of everything vital and isolate any potential rival power base. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, Major General Edward Lansdale was considered America's principal expert in counterinsurgency. Working with President Ramon Magsaysay of the Philippines, he had crafted a plan that had defeated the country's Hook guerrilla movement in the early 1950s. Counterinsurgency requires a deft hand, more political than military, and for Lansdale, the key to success was to stamp out government corruption and bring the people close to the government through various popular programs. That would deny the insurgents their cause, and they would die of isolation. Lansdale thought it folly to imagine that leftist rebels could be defeated by force. In fact, force just played into their hands, giving them a cause they could use to rally support. For insurgents, isolation from the people is death. Think of the people in your group who are working primarily for their own interests as insurgents. They are Cassius types who thrive on discontent in the organization, fanning it into dissension and factionalism. You can always work to divide such factions once you know about them. But the better solution is to keep your soldiers satisfied and contented, giving the insurgents nothing to feed on. Bitter and isolated, they will die off on their own. The divide-and-rule strategy is invaluable in trying to influence people verbally. Start by seeming to take your opponent's side on some issue, occupying their flank. Once there, however, create doubt about some part of their argument, tweaking and diverting it a bit. This will lower their resistance and maybe create a little inner conflict about a cherished idea or belief. That conflict will weaken them, making them vulnerable to further suggestion and guidance. Japan's great 17th century swordsman Miyamoto Musashi on several occasions faced bands of warriors determined to kill him. The sight of such a group would intimidate most people, or at least make them hesitate, a fatal flaw in a samurai. Another tendency would be to lash out violently, trying to kill as many of the attackers as possible all at once, but at the risk of losing control of the situation. Musashi, however, was above all else a strategist, and he solved these dilemmas in the most rational way possible. He would place himself so that the men would have to come at him in a line or at an angle. Then he would focus on killing the first man and move swiftly down the line. Instead of being overwhelmed or trying too hard, he would break the band into parts. Then he just had to kill opponent number one, while leaving himself in position to deal with opponent number two, and preventing his mind from being clouded and confused by the other attackers awaiting him. The effect was that he could retain his focus while keeping his opponents off balance, for as he proceeded down the line, they would become the ones who were intimidated and flustered. Whether you are beset by many small problems or by one giant problem, make Musashi the model for your mental process. If you let the complexity of the situation confuse you and either hesitate or lash out without thought, you will lose mental control, which will only add momentum to the negative force coming at you. Always divide up the issue at hand, first placing yourself in a central position, then proceeding down the line, killing off your problems one by one. It is often wise to begin with the smallest problem while keeping the most dangerous one at bay. Solving that one will help you create momentum, both physical and psychological, that will help you overwhelm all the rest. The most important thing is to move quickly against your enemies, as the Athenians did at Marathon. Waiting for troubles to come to you will only multiply them and give them a deadly momentum. Reversal. Dividing your forces as a way of creating mobility can be a powerful strategy, as Napoleon demonstrated with his flexible system of corps, which let him hit his enemy unpredictably from many different angles. But to make his system work, Napoleon needed precise coordination of its parts and overall control over their movements. And his goal was ultimately to bring the parts together to strike a major blow. In guerrilla warfare, a commander will disperse his forces to make them harder to hit, but this, too, demands coordination. A guerrilla army cannot succeed if the parts are unable to communicate with each other. In general, any division of your forces must be temporary, strategic, and controlled. In attacking a group in order to sow division, be careful that your blow is not too strong, for it can have the opposite effect, causing people to unite in times of great danger. That was Hitler's miscalculation during the London Blitz, his bombing campaign designed to push England out of World War II. Intended to demoralize the British public, the Blitz only made them more determined. They were willing to suffer short-term danger in order to beat him in the long run. This bonding effect was partly the result of Hitler's brutality, partly the phenomenon of a culture willing to suffer for the greater good. Finally, in a divided world, power will come from keeping your own group united and cohesive, and your own mind clear and focused on your goals. The best way to maintain unity may seem to be the creation of enthusiasm and high morale, but while enthusiasm is important, in time it will naturally wane. And if you have come to depend on it, you will fail. Far greater defenses against the forces of division are knowledge and strategic thinking. No army or group can be divided if it is aware of the enemy's intentions and makes an intelligent response. As Samuel Adams discovered, strategy is your only dependable sword and shield. Here are further reflections on the strategy of divide and conquer. From The Campaigns of Napoleon by David G. Chandler. There were, however, many occasions when the French were faced not by one but by two or a whole series of enemy armies within supporting distance of one another. Faced with such a difficult situation, Napoleon often adopted a second system of maneuver, the strategy of the central position. Very often under these circumstances, the French found themselves operating at a numerical disadvantage against the combined strength of their opponents, but could procure superior numbers against any one part of their adversary's forces. It was this second factor that the system was designed to exploit to the full. The art of generalship consists in, when actually inferior in numbers to the enemy overall, being superior to him on the battlefield. In brief, Napoleon set himself the task of isolating one part of the enemy armament, concentrating a stronger force to ensure its defeat, and if possible, its destruction, and then turning with his full strength to attack the second enemy army. That is to say, instead of a single decisive blow, he planned a series of smaller blows against scattered adversaries and set out to destroy them in detail. How could this be done? Once again, the sequence of the Napoleonic attack reveals the formula. First of all, the emperor would accumulate as much information about the forces facing him from captured newspapers, deserters, and most especially from the indications brought in by his probing cavalry patrols. From the data thus provided, he would carefully plot the known dispositions of his foes on the map, and then select the place where their respective army boundaries converged. This was the hinge or joint of the enemy's strategic dispositions, and as such was vulnerable to attack. This point would be selected by Napoleon for his initial blitzkrieg attack, carried out as often as not in full strength. Shielded by the cavalry screen, the French army would perform a crash concentration and fall like a thunderbolt on the handful of troops defending this central point. Invariably, this initial onslaught would be successful. Immediately Napoleon had massed his army at this newly captured point, he was master of the central position. That is to say, he had successfully interposed his concentrated army between the forces of his enemies, who ideally would have staggered back under the impact of the surprise blow in such a way as to increase the distance between their respective armies. This would inevitably mean that the foe would have to operate on exterior lines, i.e., have greater distances to march from one flank to the other, while the better positioned French would have a shorter distance to travel to reach either enemy. From Clausewitz on Strategy. By Tija von Kietze, Bolko von Oettinger, and Christopher Basford. A novice chess player soon learns that it is a good idea to control the center of the board. This recognition will recur, in novel disguises, in situations far from the chessboard. It may help to seek the equivalent of the center of the board in any situation, or to see that the role of the center has migrated to the flanks, or to realize that there is no board and no singular topology. From the Book of Luke. Every kingdom divided against itself is laid waste, and a divided household falls. And if Satan also is divided against himself, how will his kingdom stand? From Aesop's Fables. The Three Oxen and the Lion. There were three oxen who always grazed together. A lion had his designs upon them and wanted to eat them, but he could never get at one of them because they were always together. So he set them against each other with slanderous talk and managed to get them separated, whereupon they were isolated and he was able to eat them one after the other. From Roosevelt, The Lion and the Fox, by James McGregor Burns. Roosevelt disliked being completely committed to any one person. He enjoyed being at the center of attention and action, and the system made him the focus through which the main lines of action radiated. The main reason for Roosevelt's methods, however, involved a tenacious effort to keep control of the executive branch in the face of the centrifugal forces of the American political system. By establishing in an agency one power center that counteracted another, he made each official more dependent on White House support. The president, in effect, became the necessary ally and partner of each. He lessened bureaucratic tendencies toward self-aggrandizement. He curbed any attempt to gang up on him. He was, in effect, adapting the old method of divide and conquer to his own purposes. His technique was curiously like that of Joseph Stalin, who used the overlapping delegation of function, a close student of his methods has said, to prevent any single chain of command from making major decisions without confronting other arms of the state's bureaucracy and thus bringing the issues into the open at a high level. Roosevelt, like Stalin, was a political administrator in the sense that his first concern was power, albeit for very different ends. From the Book of Matthew. Do not think that I have come to bring peace on earth. I have not come to bring peace but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's foes will be those of his own household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me, And he who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. And lastly, from Aesop's Fables. The Plowman's Quarrelsome Sons. A plowman's sons were always quarreling. He scolded them to no avail. His words did nothing to change their ways. So he decided to teach them a practical lesson. He asked them to bring him a load of firewood. As soon as they had done this, he gave a bundle to each and told them to break it all up for him. But in spite of all their efforts, they were unable to do so. The plowman therefore undid the bundles and handed each of his sons a stick at a time. These they broke without any trouble. "So," said the father, "you too, my children, if you stay bound together, can be invincible to your enemies. But if you are divided, you will be easy to defeat." Chapter 18. Expose and attack your opponent's soft flank. The turning strategy. When you attack people directly, you stiffen their resistance and make your task that much harder. There is a better way. Distract your opponent's attention to the front, then attack them from the side, where they least expect it. By hitting them where they are soft, tender, and unprotected, you create a shock, a moment of weakness for you to exploit. Bait people into going out on a limb, exposing their weakness, then rake them with fire from the side. The only way to get stubborn opponents to move is to approach them indirectly. Turning the flank. In 1793, Louis XIV and his wife Marie Antoinette, the King and Queen of France, were beheaded by order of the new government put in place after the French Revolution. Marie Antoinette was the daughter of Maria Theresa, the Empress of Austria, and as a result of her death, the Austrians became determined enemies of France. Early in 1796, they prepared to invade the country from northern Italy, which at the time was an Austrian possession. In April of that year, the 26-year-old Napoleon Bonaparte was given command of the French army in Italy and charged with a simple mission: to prevent these Austrian armies from entering France. Under Napoleon, for the first time since the Revolution, not only were the French able to hold a defensive position, but they successfully went on the offensive, pushing the Austrians steadily east. Shocking as it was to lose to the Revolutionary Army, it was downright humiliating to be defeated by an unknown general on his first campaign. For 6 months, the Austrians sent armies to defeat Napoleon, but he forced each one to retreat into the fortress of Mantua, until finally this stronghold was crammed with Austrian soldiers. Leaving a force at Mantua to pin down the Austrians, Napoleon established his base to the north, in the pivotal city of Verona. If the Austrians were to win the war, they would somehow have to push him out of Verona and free up the starving soldiers trapped in Mantua. And they were running out of time. In October 1796, Baron Joseph Dalvinci was given command of some 50,000 Austrian soldiers and the urgent mission of expelling the French from Verona. An experienced commander and clever strategist, Dalvinci studied Napoleon's Italian campaign carefully and came to respect his enemy. To defeat this brilliant young general, the Austrians would have to be more flexible. And Dalvinci thought he had the solution. He would divide his army into two columns, one under himself, the other under the Russian general Paul Davidovich. The columns would separately march south, converging at Verona. At the same time, Dalvinci would launch a campaign of deception to make Napoleon think that Davidovich's army was small. It was in fact 18,000 men strong, merely a holding force to protect the Austrian lines of communication. If Napoleon underestimated Davidovich, the Russian general would face less opposition and his way to Verona would be smooth. Dalvinci's plan was to trap Napoleon between the jaws of these two armies. The Austrians entered northern Italy in early November. To Dalvinci's delight, Napoleon seemed to have fallen for their trick. He sent a relatively light force against Davidovich, who promptly gave the French in Italy their first real defeat, and began his advance toward Verona. Meanwhile, Dalvinci himself advanced all the way to a point not far from Verona and was poised to fall on the city from the east. As he pored over his maps, Dalvinci took pleasure in his plan. If Napoleon sent more men to stop Davidovich, he would weaken Verona against Dalvinci. If he tried to block Dalvinci's entrance from the east, he would weaken Verona against Davidovich. If he sought reinforcements from his troops at Mantua, he would free up the 20,000 Austrian soldiers trapped there, and they would gobble him up from the south. Dalvinci also knew that Napoleon's men were exhausted and hungry. Having fought for 6 months without rest, they were at a breaking point. Not even a young genius like Napoleon could escape this trap. A few days later, Dalvinci advanced to the village of Caldiero at Verona's doorstep. There he inflicted another defeat on the French troops sent to stop him. After a string of victories, Napoleon had now lost two battles in a row. The pendulum had swung against him. As Dalvinci prepared for his final pounce on Verona, he received confusing news. Against all prediction, Napoleon had in fact divided his army in Verona, but instead of sending parts of it against either Dalvinci or Davidovich, he had marched a sizable force somewhere to the southeast. The next day, this army appeared outside the town of Arcola. If the French crossed the river to Arcola and advanced a few miles north, they would directly cross Dalvinci's line of communications and of retreat, and they would be able to seize his supply depots at Villanova. Having this large French army to his rear was more than alarming. Dalvinci was forced to forget about Verona for the moment and hastily marched east. He had retreated in the nick of time and was able to halt the French before they could cross the river and attack Villanova. For several days, the two armies settled into a fiercely contested battle for the bridge at Arcola. Napoleon himself led several charges and was nearly killed. A portion of the troops blocking Mantua were dispatched north to reinforce the French at Arcola, but Dalvinci's army hunkered down, and the battle turned into a stalemate. On the third day of fighting, Dalvinci's soldiers, their lines thinned by relentless French attacks, were preparing for another battle for the bridge when they suddenly heard trumpets blaring from their southern flank. A French force had somehow crossed the river below the bridge and was marching toward the Austrian flank at Arcola. The sound of trumpets was quickly replaced by shouts and the whizzing of bullets. The sudden appearance of the French on their flank was too much for the wearied Austrians. Not waiting to see the size of the French force, they panicked and fled the scene. The French poured across the river. Dalvinci gathered up his men as best he could and managed to lead them east to safety. But the battle for Verona was lost, and with it, the doom of Mantua was sealed. Somehow, Napoleon had managed to snatch victory from defeat. The Battle of Arcola helped forge the legend of his invincibility. Interpretation. Napoleon was no magician, and his defeat of the Austrians in Italy was deceptively simple. Facing two armies converging on him, he calculated that Dalvinci's was the more imminent danger. The fight for Caldiero encouraged the Austrians to think that Verona would be defended through direct frontal confrontation. But Napoleon instead divided his army and sent the larger portion of it to threaten the Austrian supply depot and lines of communication and retreat. Had Dalvinci ignored the threat and advanced on Verona, he would have moved farther away from his critical base of operations and put himself in great jeopardy. Had he stayed put, Napoleon would have squeezed him between two armies. In fact, Napoleon knew Dalvinci would have to retreat. The threat was too real, and once he had done so, he would have relinquished the initiative. At Arcola, sensing that the enemy was tiring, Napoleon sent a small contingent to cross the river to the south and march on the Austrian flank, with instructions to make as much noise as possible. Trumpets, shouts, gunfire. The presence of this attacking force, small though it was, would induce panic and collapse. The ruse worked. This maneuver, the manoeuvre sur la derrière, Napoleon called it, would become a favorite strategy of his. Its success was based on two truths. First, generals like to place their armies in a strong frontal position, whether to make an attack or to meet one. Napoleon would often play on this tendency to face forward in battle by seeming to engage the enemy frontally. In the fog of battle, it was hard to tell that really only half of his army was deployed here, and meanwhile he would sneak the other half to the side or rear. Second, an army sensing attack from the flank is alarmed and vulnerable and must turn to face the threat. This moment of turning contains great weakness and confusion. Even an army in the stronger position, like Dal Vinci's at Verona, will almost always lose cohesion and balance as it turns. Learn from the great master himself. Attacking from the front is rarely wise. The soldiers facing you will be tightly packed in, a concentration of force that will amplify their power to resist you. Go for their flank, their vulnerable side. This principle is applicable to conflicts or encounters of any scale. Individuals often show their flank, signal their vulnerability, by its opposite, the front they show most visibly to the world. This front can be an aggressive personality, a way of dealing with people by pushing them around. Or it can be some obvious defense mechanism, a focus on keeping out intruders to maintain stability in their lives. It can be their most cherished beliefs and ideas. It can be the way they make themselves liked. The more you get people to expose this front, to show more of themselves and the directions they tend to move in, the more their unprotected flanks will come into focus. Unconscious desires, gaping insecurities, precarious alliances, uncontrollable compulsions. Once you move on their flanks, your targets will turn to face you and lose their equilibrium. All enemies are vulnerable from their sides. There is no defense against a well-designed flanking maneuver. By B. H. Littlehart. Opposition to the truth is inevitable, especially if it takes the form of a new idea, but the degree of resistance can be diminished by giving thought not only to the aim, but to the method of approach. Avoid a frontal attack on a long-established position. Instead, seek to turn it by flank movement so that a more penetrable side is exposed to the thrust of truth. Occupying the flank. As a young man, Julius Caesar, 100 to 44 BC, was once captured by pirates. They asked for a ransom of 20 talents. Laughing, he replied that a man of his nobility was worth 50 talents, and he volunteered to pay that sum. His attendants were sent for the money, and Caesar was left alone with these bloodthirsty pirates. For the weeks he remained among them, he participated in their games and revelry, even playing a little rough with them, joking that he would have them crucified some day. Amused by this spirited yet affectionate young man, the pirates practically adopted him as their own. But once the ransom was paid and Caesar was freed, he proceeded to the nearest port, manned some ships at his own expense, then went after the pirates and surprised them in their lair. At first, they welcomed him back, but Caesar had them arrested, took back the money he had given them, and, as promised, had them crucified. In the years to come, many would learn, whether to their delight or to their horror, that this was how Caesar did battle. Caesar, however, did not always exact retribution. In 62 BC, during a religious ceremony in Caesar's home, a young man named Publius Clodius was caught among the female celebrants, dressed as a woman, and cavorting with Caesar's wife, Pompeia. This was considered an outrage, and Caesar immediately divorced Pompeia, saying, "My wife must be above suspicion." Yet when Clodius was arrested and tried for sacrilege, Caesar used his money and influence to get the youth acquitted. He was more than repaid a few years later, when he was preparing to leave Rome for wars in Gaul and needed someone to protect his interests while he was away. He used his clout to get Clodius named to the political office of tribune, and in that position, Clodius doggedly supported Caesar's interests, stirring up so much trouble in the Senate with his obnoxious maneuvers that no one had the time or inclination to intrigue against the absent general. The three most powerful men in Rome at the time were Caesar, Crassus, and Pompey. Fearing Pompey, a popular and famously successful general, Crassus tried to form a secret alliance with Caesar, but Caesar balked. Instead, a few years later, he approached the wary Pompey, who was suspicious of and hostile toward Caesar as a possible future rival, and suggested they form their own alliance. In return, he promised to support some of Pompey's political proposals, which had been stalled in the Senate. Surprised, Pompey agreed, and Crassus, not wanting to be left out, agreed to join the group to form the First Triumvirate, which was to rule Rome for the next several years. In 53 BC, Crassus was killed in battle in Syria, and a power struggle quickly emerged between Pompey and Caesar. Civil war seemed inevitable, and Pompey had more support in the Senate. In 50 BC, the Senate ordered that both Caesar, who was fighting in Gaul at the time, and Pompey should send one of their legions to Syria to support the Roman army fighting there. But since Pompey had already lent Caesar a legion for the war in Gaul, he proposed to send that one to Syria, so that Caesar would have lost two legions instead of one, weakening him for the impending war. Caesar did not complain. He sent off the two legions, one of which, however, as he had expected, did not go to Syria, but was conveniently quartered near Rome, at Pompey's disposal. Before the two legions left, Caesar paid each soldier handsomely. He also instructed their officers to spread the rumor in Rome that his troops still in Gaul were exhausted, and that should he dare to send them against Pompey, they would switch sides as soon as they had crossed the Alps. Coming to believe these false reports, and expecting massive defections, Pompey did not trouble to recruit more soldiers for the imminent war, which he would later regret. In January of 49 BC, Caesar crossed the Rubicon, the river between Gaul and Italy, a dramatic, unexpected move that initiated the civil war. Caught by surprise, Pompey fled with his legions to Greece, where he began to prepare a major operation. As Caesar marched south, many of Pompey's supporters, left behind in Rome, were terrified. Caesar had established a reputation in Gaul for brutal treatment of the enemy, leveling whole towns and killing their inhabitants. Yet when Caesar took the key town of Corfinium, capturing important senators and army officers who had fought there alongside troops loyal to Pompey, he did not punish these men. In fact, he returned to them the monies his soldiers had looted in taking the town. This remarkable act of clemency became the model for his treatment of Pompey's supporters. Instead of Caesar's men switching allegiance to Pompey, it was Pompey's who now became the most ardent followers of Caesar. As a result, Caesar's march on Rome was quick and bloodless. Next, although Pompey had established his base in Greece, Caesar decided to first attack his flank, the large army he had quartered in Spain. Over several months of campaigning, he completely outmaneuvered this force, led by Pompey's generals Afranius and Petreius, and finally cornered them. They were surrounded, the situation was hopeless, and Afranius and many of the soldiers, knowing of Caesar's gentle treatment of his enemies, sent word that they were ready to surrender. But Petreius, horrified at this betrayal, ordered that any soldier who supported Caesar be slaughtered. Then, determined to go down fighting, he led his remaining men out of the camp for battle. But Caesar refused to engage. The soldiers were unable to fight. Finally, desperately low in supplies, Pompey's men surrendered. This time they could expect the worst, for Caesar knew about the massacre in the camp. Yet once again he pardoned Petreius and Afranius and simply disbanded their army, giving the soldiers supplies and money for their return to Rome. Hearing of this, the Spanish cities still loyal to Pompey quickly changed sides. In a matter of 3 months, Roman Spain had been conquered through a combination of maneuver and diplomacy, and with barely a drop of blood spilled. In the following months, Pompey's political support in Rome evaporated. All he had left was his army. His defeat by Caesar at the Battle of Pharsalus in northern Greece a year later merely put the seal on his inevitable destruction. Interpretation. Caesar discovered early on in his political life that there are many ways to conquer. Most people advance more or less directly, attempting to overpower their opponents. But unless they kill the foes they beat this way, they are merely creating long-term enemies who harbor deep resentment and will eventually make trouble. Enough such enemies and life becomes dangerous. Caesar found another way to do battle, taking the fight out of his enemies through strategic and cunning generosity. Disarmed like this, enemy becomes ally. Negative becomes positive. Later on, if necessary, when the former foe's guard is down, you can exact retribution, as Caesar did with the pirates. Behave more gently, though, and your enemy may become your best follower. So it was with Publius Clodius, who, after disgracing Caesar's home, became the devoted agent of the general's dirty work. When the civil war broke out, Caesar understood that it was a political phenomenon as much as a military one. In fact, what mattered most was the support of the Senate and the Romans. His acts of mercy were part of a calculated campaign to disarm his enemies and isolate Pompey. In essence, what Caesar was doing here was occupying his enemies' flank. Instead of attacking them frontally and engaging them directly in battle, he would take their side, support their causes, give them gifts, charm them.